CKUW 95.9 FM is independent radio thanks to donations from Alan, Diane, Doug, Jackie, and listeners just like yourself.
Hello, I'm Peter J. Radomski. This is number 0854, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program. But it's a very special edition of the Stuff File program. Yes, I know, last week there was a very special show too, our annual Meshach and Malik Christmas special, but this show is another perennial. It's our year-ending best-of show that features just a small variety of some of the great guests that we had in 2025. There won't be any Stuff File news stories this week. It's just going to be snippets of past conversations. We'll also revisit a favorite idiot of the day at the end, crowning them the idiot of the year. The guest Slater, the person who told you that this was show number 0854, was Peter J. Radomski, a friend who has been a stand-up comedian and the host of burlesque shows. Thanks, Peter, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get to the show! We start off with a boyhood crush of mine. I have been in love with actress Stephanie Powers from the time I was little and saw her in the 1960s television series The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. Well, one of my dreams came true back on show number 0804. It was to celebrate the 45th anniversary of her most popular show, Heart to Heart. It gave me a chance to talk about her film and stage career, her animal activism, and of course, it also gave me a chance to fanboy out on her just a little bit. Here is part of that conversation now. I first fell in love with you, and was a deep love, by the way, when you were the girl from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, God. Well, thank you. I'm thrilled. It was my first foray into television because I had done a couple of little parts on episodic television up till then. But, you know, in the days when you were under contract to a studio, as I was in the twilight of the studio system, I wasn't allowed to do television. But as that progressed, the studios were all divesting themselves of the contracts that they had with actors, which was their kind of moniker. They had a stable of stars, and they had a stable of actors that they were grooming into the stars that they would then loan out and make more money on. So there was a very robust system that created Hollywood, and then it fell apart, largely due to the United States government saying that it was a monopoly, sort of like Apple today, but they don't do anything about Apple. They did a lot about the movie studios. They made them divest of their holdings. Prior to that divestment, they made the product, distributed the product, and exhibited the product in chains of cinemas. At the time, that was considered a monopoly. Hmm. We now know that we are surrounded by monopoly, so it doesn't make much sense to us. But that was the end of a vibrant industry, and an industry which we're still living off of in its memory. In any event, The Girl from U.N.C.L.E., Columbia sold me to MGM to do The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. At the time, you know, an hour's television series had never had a woman starring in the title role. I guess it was a monumental moment, although we didn't make very much of it at the time. And I was only reminded of it a few years ago when PBS was doing a special program on so-called pioneers of television, and I was called, and they said, would you join us? And I said, well, I'm hardly a pioneer. But they said, oh, no, The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. was the very first time that a female had been the star of an hour-long television series.
You've also had an extensive stage career and also a film career. But one of my favorite movies was when you played Lee Remick's kid sister in Experiment in Terror.
That was the first movie under contract to Columbia. That was Blake Edwards directing and Ross Martin playing the villain. He was scary, wasn't he?
Oh, he was very scary.
Yes, and that was a kind of baptism of fire, but at the same time, I was treated so well by Blake. He was such a great director. He knew how to manipulate this rather, I think I was, what was I, 16, 17? Yeah, I had my 17th birthday on that movie. Yeah. So I was 16 years old, and he knew how to handle me. He was able to get a performance out of me.
Well, let's flash forward to Heart to Heart. It's been 45 years since that show first went on the air. How did you get the role of on that particular show?
Jennifer.
Of Jennifer Hart? You know, you had been in some series before that. Again, The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. and Feather and Father. And
No. Let me just explain a little bit about Hollywood in the days that I was growing up.
Yeah.
It was a very, very small town. And one way or another, everybody's lives seemed to crisscross. It was, yes, very much an industry town. Everybody and their brother knew somebody who worked in the industry and maybe knew a lot of people who worked in the industry or maybe worked in the industry themselves. So it was not unusual to receive a phone call from Robert Wagner, Tom Mankiewicz, and Aaron Spelling, because I knew them all extremely well. Aaron Spelling had been the coach of our girls' softball team in the Hollywood League. Robert Wagner, I had done an episode of It Takes a Thief, and then Tom Mankiewicz I practically grew up with. It was not an unusual phone call. That was the phone call to ask whether or not I'd be interested in coming and joining them to play Robert Wagner's wife in Heart to Heart, which was really explained to me by being more or less in the genre of the Thin Man movie. Do you remember the Thin Man movies?
Oh, absolutely.
Boy, yes, and William Powell. And I think they did 6 of them, if I'm not mistaken. And that was going to have that stylish, wonderful flow. But at the same time, I was in the midst of doing a production of Cyrano de Bergerac with Stacey Keach. We were opening out of town in San Francisco, and we were supposed to go to New York. You know, it was an embarrassment of riches. And Aaron Spelling said, well, look, I think there might be a newspaper strike in New York. No play would ever come into New York to open in New York when there was a newspaper strike because there was no way to publicize it or to publicize the critic. So all I can say is that was the happiest newspaper strike of my life. And I'm thrilled that the newspapers went out on strike because I was able to do the pilot of Heart to Heart.
That's just a snippet of a much longer conversation with actress Stephanie Powers. Yes, all my dreams have come true. You can go back and hear the full interview on show number 0804. And there is a slideshow and clip version of that interview on my YouTube page. On show number 0805, we spoke to David Samuels, the editor and co-founder of County Highway, a magazine styled as a 19th century American broadsheet. We talked about conspiracy theories, and I was surprised to hear him say that the very founding of America was based on a conspiracy theory. You wrote an article called Conspiracy Nation: How Americans Became Addicted to Conspiracy Theories and Why It Won't Go Away Anytime Soon and Why Censorship Only Makes It Worse. What made you write the article in the first place?
Let's back up a moment and say that America itself, the United States of America, was founded on the basis of a conspiracy theory. The conspiracy theory was that King George III was engaged in a dark plot against the liberties of North American colonists, and that in turn, that plot to deprive the colonists of their liberties as Englishmen was only the precursor to a much more general plot to deprive all Englishmen of their liberties and fasten a kind of royal dictatorship on England. Now, none of that was true. And in fact, there is a wonderful book called The Ordeal of Thomas Hutchison, written by the Harvard historian Bernard Bailyn, in which he details the work of the royal governor of Massachusetts, Thomas Hutchison, as he sort of faces this mounting hysteria from the colonists, all of whom are sure that King George is engaged in this plot. And he says, no, you know, there's no plot against your liberties, and no, England is not being turned into a dictatorship, and they won't believe him. And there's actually nothing he can do to convince the colonists otherwise. So that's number one. It's deep in our DNA. It's encoded in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, which is a thing that, you know, European nations conspicuously lack. And it's there because the belief was that the government is plotting to make slaves of us all. So this is encoded in the country's DNA from its founding. That's reason number one. Reason number two is distrust of the state. And the term conspiracy theory itself gives you a clue as to when that really kicked off in American life, which was the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The Warren Commission was assembled, these notables in American life, to convince Americans very quick that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman. He had acted alone. That was the Warren Commission's lone gunman theory, which is the basis of the Warren Commission report. The Warren Commission encountered substantial public resistance to its claims. And today, somewhere around 70% of Americans do not believe the Warren Commission report's conclusion. In the face of that public skepticism, I believe it was someone in the CIA who invented the term conspiracy theory. Now, on the surface, it was just an equivalence. There was the lone gunman theory, he acted alone, and the conspiracy theory, which meant that he acted with others. However, the term conspiracy was very cunningly chosen to make the people who believed in that theory seem nuts. And that's where the term, the modern term conspiracy theory, comes from.
Okay, well, let's deal on the, you just mentioned the Warren Commission. You said 70% of people do not believe the Warren Commission, is that correct?
Correct. As of now, I think as of 2023, the last time I saw a poll, I think it was 71% believe that it is likely or highly likely that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone. So a vast majority of Americans think the Warren Commission was a lie, right?
Is that a number that has been constant, or has it been growing? Has it changed?
That's a great question. The answer is that it's been growing, and part of the reason it's been growing is the third reason, which is the collapse of the mainstream press in America due to the coming of the internet and social media, and then the use of what remained of the mainstream press as a sort of government propaganda apparatus, and the censoring of social media and the sort of overt attempts at censorship, which we've not really seen in this country since World War II, really put the final nail in the coffin of the credibility of the mainstream press. People looked at the mainstream press as a organ of government propaganda, which it became, and as something that was being censored by the government. And they looked at the government as a thing that they distrust. And so the combination of that historical propensity to believe in conspiracy theories, the increasing lack of faith in the federal government, and the collapse of 20th century media structures have all brought about a state of affairs in which conspiracy theory is simply the way people communicate what they think happened, because they don't believe that they can know from, you know, formerly reliable sources what actually did happen.
That was a snippet of an interview with David Samuels, the editor and co-founder of County Highway. In that clip, he mentioned the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Well, we have another take on that one with someone who has been a guest multiple times. Former incarcerated gangster Louis Ferrante, who has written a trilogy on the Mafia. The first book was Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. The second book in the series is called Borgata, Clash of Titans, A History of the American Mafia. He shared his thoughts about the Kennedy assassination on show number 0806. You mentioned the Kennedy assassination several times now, and I'm just wondering, you know, the Warren Commission came out with their theory being that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman and he was the only one involved. You've mentioned it several times. Are you saying that the Mafia is somehow involved at a deeper level?
They certainly are. There's a tremendous amount of evidence that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover overlooked, disregarded. Hoover concluded that Oswald, the moment after Jack Ruby shot Oswald, Hoover knew and had mentioned privately that this is a typical mob hit, silencing somebody who might talk. Although publicly he said Oswald was a lone nut and Ruby was another lone nut who just happened to shoot Oswald. You know, that was the public stance. And there was a lot of reasons, I get deep into them in the book, for Hoover to take that stance. I think that big people in big positions have the national and international chessboard in their minds at all time, whereas a small guy like myself just wants to hear the truth. But those people have to consider other things. So there were reasons why Hoover wanted to cover it up. And then as far as the conclusions drawn by the Warren Commission, interestingly, the same conclusion that Hoover drew within 20 minutes of Oswald's death are the exact identical conclusions the Warren Commission drew months later when they concluded their quote-unquote extensive report. And the reason being is that Hoover controlled the evidence that the Warren Commission would see. The Warren Commission was an investigative body, but not a law enforcement body. So they had no access to investigative evidence that would have to be obtained from Hoover. So Hoover then played a dirty game, as far as I was concerned, with regard to what he showed them and what he didn't, what he told them and what he didn't, what he chose to hold back. Also, the CIA director, he'd been ousted by John F. Kennedy, Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles was a CIA director, and he got thrown out by Kennedy, or kind of forced to resign, after the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was sort of a debacle, they felt like. Most people did. Felt like we left the Cuban exiles stranded on the beach when they were attempting to overrun Castro and retake their tiny island in the name of democracy again. Well, after Dulles was gone, Dulles was sort of really, really bitter against the Kennedys. He felt like they dropped the ball and blamed it on him. At some point or another, Dulles becomes also a major part of the Warren Commission. It's proven that he was working hand in hand with the Mafia to assassinate Castro. And he did not want that to come out and the American public to hear about that the CIA was working hand in hand with the Mafia to kill a foreign leader. So he worked very closely with all of the other people on the Warren Commission to make sure that those CIA secrets stayed secrets for a long time. And they only came out, gosh, maybe 15 years later during the House Assassinations Committee, which I mentioned at the top of our interview, which is in later on, 1978, 1979.
That was part of a double segment with former gangster Louis Ferrante, author of a trilogy on mafia history. By the way, the third and final book of the trilogy is called Borgata, Autumn of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. And it comes out late in 2026. You can go back to show number 0806 to hear that double segment. And if you think he has thoughts on the JFK assassination, then go back and listen to the segment where he feels that the RFK assassination in 1968 of the president's brother was mobbed up too. Again, there is a slideshow and clip version of that double interview on my YouTube page. And the link will be on our website at thestufffile.com. Just go to that page for this show, which is number 0854, and you'll be able to find the link to that video. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
What do you call a kid who doesn't believe in Santa? A rebel without a clause.
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests,
more news, and an idiot of the day. Coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
I'm standing Nova Scotia proud for Canada. This is Anne Murray. Early in my career, I received a lot of pressure to move to the U.S., but I just couldn't do it. Canada was my safe haven, my light at the end of the tunnel, and it still is. Buy Canadian. Shop as if your country depends upon it. Keep your money in Canada for Canada.
Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
This is a special best-of edition of the Stuff File program, looking back at snippets of some of the conversations we've had over the year. Have you ever thought of getting married in a jail? Or spending your first night in holy matrimony canoodling in a cell? A former prison in New Brunswick is now the Dorchester Jail Bed and Breakfast. Earlier in the year, they made the news because a wedding took place in the former prison that was built in 1875. The owners of the Dorchester Jail are Natasha Marsh and Bill Steele, and we talked to Natasha back on show number 0821 during their flurry of press attention. You must be getting a lot of attention just because of it.
We certainly are. It was our first ever wedding, and we actually don't even know the brides.
But besides that, you opened up this bed and breakfast a little while ago, and though you had the first wedding there, it's not the first time that people spent their first night as a couple in your bed and breakfast.
So we've had at least 8 brides and grooms come and spend their first night of holy matrimony here with us. They had to start their life sentence off right, and there's no better place to do that than in jail.
So how did the bed and breakfast come about in the first place?
So we purchased the jail in 2017. My husband, he's quite eclectic. He likes some kind of different things there, macabre things and morbid things. So when we first bought the jail, we weren't too sure what we were going to do with it. We knew we wanted to live here in the jail, but we didn't know what we wanted to do with the rest of the space. So we just joked with each other, like, you know what? We can't be the only crazy people that might want to spend a night in jail. Like, let's try a bed and breakfast. 2017, our first summer, we were sold out essentially every night. That's when we kind of thought that we had something.
I'm sure it was very, very popular when you first started, but then you must have hit head on the pandemic.
Oh, yes.
So what was that like for you?
Fortunately, the way that the building is structured, we were still able to have guests through for the B&B experience, but we were only able to have one family or one couple through at a time, which made things a little difficult. But there was so much interest for people to come and stay that it really encouraged us to keep the doors open.
This is a former prison that was built in 1875. So what kind of renovations did you have to do in order to make this an accommodating bed and breakfast?
So my husband and I, we've tried to keep the building as original as we possibly can. They certainly don't make them like this anymore. We put smoke detectors in each of the cells, and we disabled the locks in the cells where people sleep so we don't have any accidents or have anyone staying any longer than they might want to. Pardon me, we updated a little bit of the electrical and the plumbing into our residence. So we actually live in the part of the building where the warden and his family used to live.
So when people stay in the cells, I mean, there's the one thing that is common to most jails, and that there really isn't any privacy. There's bars and you can't get out, but there's no privacy. What have you done to give a modicum of privacy to people who are enjoying the bed and breakfast experience?
We do provide each of our cells with a privacy curtain. Of course, it's black and white striped. We've got the aesthetic here. A lot of people, they really enjoy the experience, especially when there is other people in the cells, like down the hallway and stuff. It really gives that real jail vibe. And we find a lot of people down in the common area kind of reminiscing and enjoying the experience together. So it's nice to see people can have a bit of camaraderie in the jail as well.
There are some people who have, shall we say, a notorious history for being in that particular prison. I mean, the prison itself has a notorious history. I guess one of the biggest stories that people talk about are the Bannister brothers. They were hung at the jail for the murder of three members of the same family in Moncton. Do people come and visit because of the lore of what took place in that jail?
Arthur and Daniel Bannister were actually hung inside of the jail on September 23rd, 1936. But they still had singular hangings here up in the jail up until 1964. Definitely, it's one of the most infamous or some of the most infamous inmates that were ever housed and executed here. Very sadly, as a parent, this kind of breaks my heart, but the boys were essentially hung because of their mother, because they were asked to do their mother's dirty work for her.
Wow. And so did she get away with this, or was she convicted herself?
No, she was also incarcerated here for a short period of time.
Okay.
At that period of time, the jail was co-ed, so it used to house men and women until about the 60s. So she was also incarcerated here, and they were actually all in the same hallway together. So the female inmates were actually housed in the death row hallway. So she was 20 feet away from where her sons were being held in death row.
Wow. And when did the jail close exactly?
So the jail's only been closed for about 27 years. It closed in 1998.
The people in the area, I bet when they closed the jail, they never thought it would become a bed and breakfast.
I don't think so. We gave them a shock.
From show number 0821, that was Natasha Marsh, co-owner of the Dorchester Jail Bed and Breakfast in New Brunswick. Okay, so you might not be interested in spending your vacation on Canada's East Coast in a jail. But if you are ever traveling to Prince Edward Island, you might want to stop by the Canadian Potato Museum, located in O'Leary, PEI. Back on show number 0835, we spoke to the manager, Donna Rowley. You really can't miss the Canadian Potato Museum because there's a giant potato outside.
There is. Yes, there is. That potato's been standing there since 1997.
How did it get there? Like, who decided we need a giant potato?
So the Potato Museum itself opened in 93. Just a little backstory. The Community Museum of O'Leary is kind of what it consisted of. And there was a small little display about the potato industry in that little exhibit. And someone just in passing mentioned, and it was literally just a small conversation they had, is such a small display about potatoes, and the industry is so big on the island, you would think there would be a larger exhibit somewhere. And literally that's kind of what planted the seed, if I want to say that, of starting the Potato Museum. So long story short, they opened Potato Museum in 93. And then again, somebody had a conversation with one of our economic development officers, Eva Rodgson is her name. And it was just a local farmer that said, we should have something for people to take a photo of when they come to that museum. We should have a giant potato somewhere in O'Leary. They didn't really know where they were going to put it, but eventually it did land on our doorstep, basically. So it is probably the most photographed iconic structure in O'Leary that people take a photo of before they enter the museum. That's kind of how that came about.
Now, I understand that O'Leary has less than 1,000 people, and your Canadian Potato Museum attracts thousands.
We did. Last year was a record for us. We hit almost a 20,000 visitation for traffic for the museum, which is the highest in all the years that I've worked there. When I originally started, it seems like 100 years ago sometimes, but traffic was probably under 2,000-3,000 people would come through the museum. And it's literally increased its visitation over those years up to last year was just under 20,000. So
when one goes to the Canadian Potato Museum, what can you expect to see? What's the big attraction that is there that draws the people in?
So the museum itself is based on history, and it is an educational museum. We have an interpretive center that kind of walks you through a little bit of the the history behind the humble potato, we'll say, kind of where it began and kind of how it made its way to Prince Edward Island itself and as well to Canada.